From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Werewolf by Clemens Hausman. The great farm hall was ablaze with the firelight and noisy with laughter and talk and many-sounding work. None could be idle, but the very young and the very old. Little Roll, who was hugging a puppy, and old Trelia, who Pulseed's hand fumbled over her knitting. The early evening had closed in, and the farm servants had come in from the outdoor work and assembled in the ample hall, which had spaces for scores of workers. Several of the men were engaged in carving, and to these were yielded the best places in light. Others made a repaired fishing tackle and harness, and a great seine neck occupied three pairs of hands. Of the women, most were sorting and mixing eider feathers and chopping straw of the same. Looms were there, though not in present use. Three wheels whirred emulously, and the finest and swiftest thread of the three ran between the fingers of the housemistress. Near her were some children, busy too, plaiting wicks for candles and lamps. Each group of workers had a lamp in its center, and those furthest from the fire had extra warmth from two braziers filled with glowing wood embers, replenished now and again from the generous hearth. But the flicker of the great fire was manifest to remotest corners and prevailed beyond the limits of the lesser lights. Little Roll grew tired of this puppy, dropped it incontinently, and made an onslaught on Terror, the old wolfhound, who basked, dozing, whimpering, and twitching in his hunting dreams. Prone went Roll beside Terror, his young arms around the shaggy neck, his curls against the black jowl. Terror gave a perfunctionary lick and stretched with a sleepy sigh. Roll growled and rolled and shoved invitingly, but could gain nothing from the old dog but placid toleration and a half-observant blink. "Take that, then," said Roll, indignant at this ignoring of his advances, and sent the puppy sprawling against the dignity that disdained him as playmate. The dog took no notice, and the child wandered off to find amusement elsewhere. The baskets of white eider feathers caught his eye far off in a distant corner. He slipped under the table and crept along on all fours, the ordinary commonplace custom of walking down a room upright not being to his fancy. When close to the women, he lay still for a moment watching, with his elbows on the floor and his chin in his palms. One of the women, seeing him, nodded and smiled, and presently he crept out behind her skirts and passed, hardly noticed from one to another, till he found opportunity to possess himself of a large handful of feathers. With these he traversed the length of the room under the table again, and emerged near the spinners. At the feet of the youngest, he curled himself round, sheltered by her knees from the observation of the others, and disarmed her of interference by secretly displaying his handful with a confiding smile. A dubious nod satisfied him, and presently proceeded with the play he had planned. He took a tuft of the white down and gently shook it free of his fingers, close to the whirl of the wheel. The wind of the swift motion took it, spun it round and round in widening circles, till it floated above like a slow white moth. Little Roll's eyes danced, and the row of his small teeth shone in a silent laugh of delight. Another and another the white tufts was sent whirling round like a winged thing in a spider's web, and floating clear at last, presently the handful failed. Roll sprawled forward to survey the room and contemplate another journey under the table. His shoulder thrusting forward checked the wheel for an instant. He shifted hazily. The wheel flew on with a jerk, and the thread snapped. "Naughty rolls," said the girl. The swiftest wheel stopped also, and the housemistress. Roll's aunt leaned forward, and sighting the low curly head, gave a warning against mischief and sent him off to old Trella's corner. Roll obeyed, and after a discreet period of obedience, sidled out again down the length of the room furthest from his aunt's eye. As he slipped in among the men, they looked up to see that their tools might be, as far as possible, out of reach of Roll's hands, and close to their own. Nevertheless, before long he managed to secure a fine chisel and take off its point on the leg of the table. The carver's strong objections to this disconcerted Roll, who for 5 minutes thereafter effaced himself under the table. During this seclusion, he contemplated the many pairs of legs that surrounded him and almost shot out the light of the fire. How very odd some of the legs were. Some were curved where they should be straight. Some were straight where they should be curved. And as Roll said to himself, they all seemed screwed on differently. Some were tucked away modestly under the benches. Others were thrust far out under the table, encroaching on Roll's own particular domain. He stretched out his own short legs and regarded them critically, and after comparison favorably. Why were not all legs made like his? Or like his? These legs, approved by Roll, were a little apart from the rest. He crawled opposite and again made comparison. His face grew quite solemn as he thought of the innumerable days to come before his legs could be as long and strong. He hoped they would be just like those. His models, as straight as to bone, as curved as to muscle. A few moments later, Sewin of the long legs felt a small hand caressing his foot and looking down, met the upturned eyes of his little cousin Roll. Lying on his back, still softly patting and stroking the young man's foot, the child was quiet and happy for a good while. He watched the movements of the strong, deft hands and the shifting of the bright tools. Now and then minute chips of wood, puffed off by Sewin, fell down upon his face. At last he raised himself very gently, lest a jog should wake impatience in the carver, and crossing his own legs round Sewin's ankle, clasping with his arms too, laid his head against the knee. Such an act is evidence of a child's most wonderful hero worship. Quite content was Roll, and more than content, when Sewin passed a minute to joke and pat his head and pull his curls. Quiet he remained as long as quiescence is possible to limbs young as his. Sewin forgot he was there, hardly noticed when his leg was gently released, and never saw the stealthy abstraction of one of his tools. 10 minutes thereafter was a lamentable wail from low on the floor, rising to the full pitch of Roll's healthy lungs, for his hand was gashed across and the copious bleeding terrified him. Then there was soothing and comforting, washing and binding, in a modicum of scolding till the loud outcry sank into occasional sobs, and the child, tear-stained and subdued, was returned to the chimney corner, where Trella nodded. In the reaction after pain of fright, Roll found that the quiet of the firelit corner was to his mind. Terror, too, disdained him no longer, but roused by sobs, showed all the concern and sympathy that a dog can by licking and wistful watching. A little shame weighed also upon his spirits. He wished he had not cried quite so much. He remembered how once Sewin had come home with his arm torn down from the shoulder and a dead bear, and how he had never winced nor said a word, though his lips turned white with pain. Poor little Roll gave an extra sighing sob over his own faint-hearted shortcomings. The light and motion of the great fire began to tell strange stories to the child, and the wind in the chimney roared a corroborative note now and then. The great black mouth of the chimney, impending high over the hearth, received the murky coils of smoke and brightness of aspiring sparks as into a mysterious gulf, and beyond in the high darkness were muttering and wailing and strange doings, so that sometimes the smoke rushed back in panic and curled out and up to the roof and condensed itself to invisibility among the rafters. And then the wind would rage after its lost prey, rattling and shrieking at window and door. In a lull after one such loud gust, Roll lifted his head in surprise and listened. A lull had also come on the babble of talk, and thus could be heard with strange distinctness a sound without the door. The sound of a child's voice, a child's hands. "Open! Open! Let me in!" piped the little voice from low down, lower than the handle, and the latch rattled as though a tiptoe child reached up to it, and soft small knocks were struck. One near the door sprang up and opened it. "No one is here," he said. Tur lifted his head and gave utterance to a loud howl, prolonged, most dismal. Sewin, not able to believe that his ears had deceived him, got up and went to the door. It was a dark night. The clouds were heavy with snow that had fallen fitfully when the wind lulled. Untrodden snow lay up on the porch. There was no sight nor sound of any human being. Sewin strained his eyes far and near, only to see dark sky, pure snow, and a line of black fir trees on a hill brow, bowing down before the wind. "It must have been the wind," he said, and closed the door. Many faces looked scared. The sound of a child's voice had been so distinct, and the words, "Open, open, let me in." The wind might creak the wood or rattle the latch, but could not speak with a child's voice, nor knock with the soft, plain blows that a plump fist gives. And the strange, unusual howl of the wolfhound was an omen to be feared, be the rest what it might. Strange things were said by one and other, till the rebuke of the housemistress quelled them into far-off whispers. For a time after, there was uneasiness, constraint, and silence. Then the chill fear thawed by degrees, and the babble of talk flowed on again. Yet half an hour later, a very slight noise outside the door sufficed to arrest every hand, every tongue. Every head was raised, every eye fixed in one direction. "It is Christian. He is late," said Sewin. "No, no. This is a feeble shuffle, not a young man's tread." With a sound of uncertain feet came the hard tap-tap of a stick against the door, and the high-pitched voice of old. "Open, open, let me in." Again, Tur flung up his head in a long, doleful howl. Before the echo of the tapping stick and the high voice had fairly died away, Sewin had sprung across to the door and flung it wide. "No one again," he said in a steady voice, though his eyes looked startled as he stared out. He saw the lonely expanse of snow, the clouds swagging low, and between the two the lines of dark fir trees, bowing in the wind. He closed the door without word of comment and recrossed the room. A score of blanched faces were turned to him as though he were the solver of the enigma. He could not be unconscious of this mute eye questioning, and it disturbed his resolute air of composure. He hesitated, glanced toward his mother, the housemistress, then back at the frightened folk, and gravely before them all made the sign of the cross. There was a flutter of hands as the sign was repeated by all, and the dead silence was stirred as by a huge sigh, for the held breath of many was freed as if the sign gave magic relief. Even the housemistress was perturbed. She left her wheel and crossed the room to her son and spoke with him for a moment in a low tone that none could overhear. But a moment later her voice was high-pitched and loud so that all might benefit by her rebuke of the heathen chatter of one of the girls. Perhaps she essayed to silence thus her own misgivings and forebodings. No other voice dared speak now with its natural fullness. Low tones made intermittent murmurs, and now and then silence drifted over the whole room. The handling of tools was as noiseless as might be, and suspended on the instant if the door rattled in a gust of wind. After a time, Sewin left his work, joined the group nearest the door, and loitered there on the pretense of giving advice and help to the unskillful. A man's tread was heard outside in the porch. "Christian," said Sewin and his mother simultaneously, he confidently, she authoritatively, to set the checked wheels going again. But Tur flung up his head with an appalling howl. "Open, open, let me in." It was a man's voice, and the door shook and rattled as a man's strength beat against it. Sewin could feel the planks quivering as on the instant his hand was upon the door, flinging it open to face the blank porch and beyond, only snow and sky and firs aslant in the wind. He stood for a long minute with the open door in his hand. The bitter wind swept in with its icy chill, but a deadlier chill of fear came swifter and seemed to freeze the beating of hearts. Sven snatched up a great bearskin cloak. "Sven, where are you going?" "No further than the porch, mother," said he, stepped out and closed the door. He wrapped himself in the heavy fur, and leaning against the most sheltered wall of the porch, steeled his nerves to face the devil and all his works. No sound of voices came from within, but he could hear the crackle and roar of the fire. It was bitterly cold. His feet grew numb, but he forbore, stamping them into warmth lest the sound should strike panic within. Nor would he leave the porch, nor print a footmark on the untrodden snow that testified conclusively to no human voices and hands having approached the door since snow fell 2 hours or more ago. "When the wind drops, there will be more snow," thought Sven. For the best part of an hour he kept his watch and saw no living thing, heard no unwanted sound. "I will freeze here no longer," he muttered and re-entered. One woman gave a half-suppressed scream as his hand was laid on the latch, and then a gasp of relief as he came in. No one questioned him, only his mother said in a tone of forced unconcern, "Could you not see Christian coming?" as though she were made anxious only by the absence of her younger son. Hardly had Sven stamped near to the fire than clear knocking was heard at the door. Tur leaped from the hearth, his eyes red as the fire, his fangs showing white in the black jowl, his neck ridged and bristling and overleaping roll, ramped at the door, barking furiously. Outside the door, a clear, mellow voice was calling. Tur's bark made the words undistinguishable. No one offered to stir toward the door before Sven. He stalked down the room resolutely, lifted the latch, and swung back the door. A white-robed woman glided in. No wraith, living, beautiful, young. Tur leapt upon her. Lithely, she balked the sharp fangs with folds of her long fur robe, and snatching from her girdle a small two-edged axe, whirled it up for a blow of defense. Sven caught the dog by the collar and dragged him off, yelling and struggling. The stranger stood in the doorway motionless, one foot set forward, one arm flung up, till the housemistress hurried down the room, and Sven, relinquishing to others the furious Tur, turned again to close the door and offer excuses for so fierce a greeting. Then she lowered her arm, slung the axe in its place at her waist, loosened the furs about her face, and shook over her shoulders the long white robe, all, as it were, with the sway of one movement. She was a maiden, tall and very fair. The fashion of her dress was strange, half masculine, yet not unwomanly. A fine fur tunic, reaching but below the knee, was all the skirt she wore. Below were the cross-bound shoes and leggings that a hunter wears. A white fur cap was set low upon the brow, and from its edge strips of fur fell, lappet-wise, about her shoulders, two of which at her entrance had been drawn forward and crossed about her throat, but now loosened and thrust back, left unbidden, long plaits of fair hair that lay forward on shoulder and breast, down to the ivory-studded girdle where the axe gleamed. Sven and his mother led the stranger to the hearth without question or sign of curiosity, till she voluntarily told her tale of a long journey to distant kindred, a promised guide unmet, and signals and landmarks mistaken. "Alone?" exclaimed Sven in astonishment. "Have you journeyed thus far, 100 leagues, alone?" She answered yes with a little smile. "Over the hills and the wastes? Why, the folk there are savage and wild as beasts." She dropped her hand upon her axe with a laugh of scorn. "I fear neither man nor beast. Some few fear me." And then she told strange tales of fierce attack and defense, and of the bold, free huntress life she had led. Her words came a little slowly and deliberately, as though she spoke in a scarce familiar tongue. Now and then she hesitated and stopped in a phrase, as if for lack of some word. She became the center of a group of listeners. The interest she excited dissipated in some degree, the dread inspired by the mysterious voices. There was nothing ominous about this bright, fair reality, though her aspect was strange. Little Roll crept near, staring at the stranger with all his might. Unnoticed, he softly stroked and patted a corner of her soft white robe that reached to the floor in ample folds. He laid his cheek against it caressingly and then edged closer up to her knees. "What is your name?" he asked. The stranger smiled and ready answer as she looked down, saved Roll from the rebuke merited by his question. "My real name," she said, "would be uncouth to your ears and tongues. The folk of this country have given me another name, and from this," she laid her hand on the fur robe, "they call me Whitefell." Little Roll repeated it to himself, stroking and patting as before. "Whitefell, Whitefell." The fair face and soft, beautiful dress pleased Roll. He knelt up with his eyes on her face in an air of uncertain determination, like a robin's on a doorstep, and plumped his elbows into her lap with a little gasp at his own audacity. "Roll," exclaimed his aunt, but "Oh, let him," said Whitefell, smiling and stroking his head, and Roll stayed. He advanced farther and, panting at his own adventurousness in the face of his aunt's authority, climbed up onto her knees. Her welcoming arms hindered any protest. He nestled happily, fingering the accent, the ivory studs in her girdle, the ivory clasp at her throat, the plaits of fair hair, rubbing his head against the softness of her fur-clad shoulder, with a child's confidence in the kindness of beauty. Whitefell had not uncovered her head, only knotted the pendant fur loosely behind her neck. Roll reached up his hand toward it, whispering her name to himself. "Whitefell, Whitefell," then slid his arms around her neck and kissed her once, twice. She laughed delightedly and kissed him again. "The child plagues you," said Selwyn. "No, indeed," she answered, with an earnestness so intense as to seem disproportionate to the occasion. Roll settled himself again on her lap and began to unwind the bandage bound round his hand. He paused a little when he saw where the blood had soaked through, then went on till his hand was bare and the cut displayed, gaping and long, though only skin deep. He held it up toward Whitefell, desirous of her pity and sympathy. At sight of it and the blood-stained linen, she drew in her breast suddenly. Clasp rolled to her, hard, till he began to struggle. Her face was hidden behind the boy so that none could see his expression. It had lighted up with a most awful glee. Afar beyond the fir grove, beyond the low hill, behind the absent Christian was hastening his return. From daybreak he had been afoot, carrying summons to a bear hunt to all the best hunters of the farms and hamlets that lay within a radius of 12 miles. Nevertheless, having been detained till a late hour, he now broke into a run, going with a long, smooth stride that fast made the miles diminish. He entered the midnight blackness of the fir grove with scarcely slackened pace, though the path was invisible, and passing through into the open again, sighted the farm, lying a furlong off down the slope. Then he sprang out freely and almost on the instant gave one great sideways leap and stood still. There in the snow was the track of a great wolf. His hand went to his knife, his only weapon. He stooped, knelt down to bring his eyes to the level of a beast and peered about, his teeth set, his heart beating. A little harder than the pace of his running had set it. A solitary wolf, nearly always savage and of large size, is a formidable beast that will not hesitate to attack a single man. This wolf track was the largest Christian had ever seen, and as far as he could judge, recently made. It led from under the fir tree down the slope. Well for him, he thought, was the delay that had so vexed him before. Well for him that he had not passed through the dark fir grove when that danger of jaws lurked there. Going warily, he followed the track. It led down the slope, across a broad ice-bound stream, along the level beyond leading toward the farm. A less sure knowledge than Christians might have doubted of it being a wolf track, and guessed it to be made by Tur or some large dog. But he was sure, and knew better than to mistake between a wolf's and a dog's footmark. Straight on toward the farm. Christian grew surprised and anxious of a prowling wolf daring so near. he drew his knife and pressed on. More hastily, more keenly eyed. Oh, that Tur were with him. Straight on, even to the very door where the snow failed. His heart seemed to give a great leap and then stop. There the track ended. Nothing lurked in the porch and there was no sign of return. The fir stood straight against the sky. The clouds lay low, for the wind had fallen and a few snowflakes came drifting down. In a horror of surprise, Christian stood dazed a moment. Then he lifted the latch and went in. His glance took in all the old familiar forms and faces, and with them that of the stranger, fur-clad and beautiful. The awful truth flashed upon him. He knew what she was. Only a few were startled by the rattle of the latch as he entered. The room was filled with bustle and movement, for it was the supper hour and all tools were being put aside and trestles and tables shifted. Christian had no knowledge of what he did or what he said. He moved and spoke mechanically, half thinking that soon he must wake from this horrible dream. Sewin and his mother supposed him to be cold and dead tired, and spared all unnecessary questions. And he found himself seated beside the hearth, opposite that dreadful thing that looked like a beautiful girl, watching her every movement, curdling with horror to see her fonder role. Swen stood near them both, intent upon Whitefell also, but how differently. She seemed unconscious of the gaze of both, neither aware of the chill dread in the eyes of Christian nor of Sewin's warm admiration. These two brothers, who were twins, contrasted greatly despite their striking likeness. They were alike in regular profile, fair brown hair and deep blue eyes, but Sewin's features were perfect as a young god's, while Christian's showed faulty details. Thus the line of his mouth was set too straight, the eyes shelved too deeply back, and the contour of the face flowed in less generous curves than Sewin's. Their height was the same, but Christian was too slender for perfect proportion, while Sewin's well-knit frame, broad shoulders, and muscular arms made him preeminent for manly beauty as well as for strength. As a hunter, Sewin was without rival, as a fisher without rival. All the countryside acknowledged him to be the best wrestler, rider, dancer, singer. Only in speed could he be surpassed, and in that only by his younger brother. All others Sewin could distance fairly, but Christian could outrun him easily. Aye, he could keep pace with Sewin's most breathless burst and laugh and talk the while. Christian took little pride in his fleetness of foot, counting a man's legs to be the least worthy of his limbs. He had no envy of his brother's athletic superiority, though to several feats he had made a moderate second. He loved as only a twin can love, proud of all that Sewin did, content with all that Sewin was, humbly content also that his own great love should not be so exceedingly returned, since he knew himself to be so far less love-worthy. Christian dared not, in the midst of women and children, launch the horror that he knew into words. He waited to consult his brother, but Sewin did not, or would not notice the signal he made, and kept his face always turned toward Whitefell. Christian drew away from the hearth, unable to remain passive with that dread upon him. "Where is Tur?" he said suddenly, then catching sight of the dog in a distant corner. "Why is he chained there?" "He flew at the stranger," one answered. Christian's eyes glowed. "Yes?" he said interrogatively, and rising without a word to the corner where Tur was chained, the dog rose up to meet him, as piteous and indignant as a dumb beast can be. He stroked the black head. "Good Tur, brave dog." They knew. They only and the man and the dumb dog had comfort of each other. Christian's eyes turned again towards Whitefell. Tur's also, and he strained against the length of the chain. Christian's hand lay on the dog's neck, and he felt it ridge and bristle with a quivering of impotent fury. Then he began to quiver in like manner with a fury born of reason, not instinct, so impotent morally as was Tur physically. Oh, the woman's form that he dare not touch. Anything but that, and he with Tur would be free to kill or be killed. Then he returned to ask fresh questions. "How long has the stranger been here?" "She came out about half an hour before you." "Who opened the door to her?" "Swen. No one else dared." The tone of the answer was mysterious. "Why?" queried Christian. "Has anything strange happened? Tell me." For answer, he was told, in a low undertone, of the summons at the doors thrice repeated, without human agency, and of Tur's ominous howls and of Samhain's fruitless watch outside. Christian turned toward his brother in a torment of impatience for a word apart. The board was spread, and Samhain was leading Whitefell to the guest place. This was more awful. She would break bread with them under the roof tree. He started forward and, touching Samhain's arm, whispered an urgent entreaty. Samhain stared and shook his head in angry impatience. Thereupon Christian would take no morsel of food. His opportunity came at last. Whitefell questioned of the landmarks of the country, and of one Cairn Hill, which was an appointed meeting place at which she was due that night. The housemistress and Samhain both exclaimed. "It is 3 miles away," said Samhain, "with no place for shelter but a wretched hut. Stay with us this night, and I will show you the way tomorrow." Whitefell seemed to hesitate. 3 miles, she said, "then I should be able to see or hear a signal." "I will look out," said Samhain. "Then if there be no signal, you must not leave us." He went to the door. Christian silently followed him out. "Samhain, do you know what she is?" Samhain, surprised at the vehement grasp and low hoarse voice, made answer. "She? Who? Whitefell?" "Yes. She is the most beautiful girl I've ever seen." "She is a werewolf." Samhain burst out laughing. "Are you mad?" he asked. "No, hear, see for yourself." Christian drew him out of the porch, pointing to the snows where the footmarks had been, for now they were not. Snow was falling, and the very dint was blotted out. "Well," asked Samhain, "had you come when I signed to you, you would have seen for yourself." "Seen what?" "The footprints of a wolf leading up to the door, none leading away." It was impossible not to be startled by the tone alone, though it was hardly above a whisper. Samhain eyed his brother anxiously, but in the darkness could make nothing of his face. Then he laid his hands kindly and reassuringly on Christian's shoulders and felt that he was quivering with excitement and horror. "One sees strange things," he said, "when the cold has gotten to the brain behind the eyes. You came in cold and worn out." "No," interrupted Christian, "I saw the track first on the brow of the slope and followed it down right here to the door. This is no delusion." Samhain in his heart felt positive that it was. Christian was given to daydreams and strange fancies, though never had he been possessed with so mad a notion before. "Don't you believe me?" said Christian desperately. "You must. I swear it is the same truth. Are you blind? Why, even Tur knows." "You'll be clear-headed tomorrow, after a night's rest. Then come too, if you will, with Whitefell to the Hail Cairn, and if you have doubt still, watch and follow and see what footprints she leaves." Galled by Samhain's evident contempt, Christian turned abruptly to the door. Samhain caught him back. "What now, Christian? What are you going to do?" "You do not believe me. My mother shall." Samhain's grasp tightened. "You shall not tell her," he said authoritatively. Customarily, Christian was so docile to his brother's mastery that it was now a surprising thing when he wrenched himself free vigorously and said as determinedly as Samhain, "She shall know." But Samhain was nearer the door and would not let him pass. "There has been scare enough for one night already. If this notion of yours will keep, broach it tomorrow." Christian would not yield. "Women are so easily scared," pursued Samhain, "and are ready to believe any folly without proof. Be a man, Christian, and fight this notion of a werewolf by yourself." "If you would believe me," began Christian. "I believe you to be a fool," said Samhain, losing patience. "Another, who was not your brother, might think you a knave and guess that you had transformed Whitefell into a werewolf because she smiled more readily on me than on you." The jest was not without foundation, for the grace of Whitefell's bright looks had been bestowed on him, on Christian never a whit. Samhain's coxcombry was always frank and most forgivable, and not without justification. "If you want an ally," continued Samhain, "confine an old Trella. Out of her stores of wisdom, if her memory holds good, she can instruct you in the orthodox manner of tackling a werewolf. If I remember aright, you should watch the suspected person till midnight, when the beast's form must be resumed and retained even after, if a human eye sees to change. Or better still, sprinkle hands and feet with holy water, which is certain death. Oh, never fear, but old Trella will be equal to the occasion." Swain's contempt was no longer good-humored, for he began to feel excessively annoyed at this monstrous doubt of Whitefell, but Christian was too deeply distressed to take offense. You speak of them as old wives' tale, but if you had seen the proof I have seen, you would be ready at least to wish them true, if not also to put them to the test. Well, said Samwen with a laugh that had a little sneer in it, put them to the test. I will not mind that, if you only keep your notions to yourself. Now, Christian, give me your word for silence. We will freeze here no longer. Christian remained silent. Swain put his hand on his shoulder again, and vainly tried to see his face in the darkness. We have never quarreled yet, Christian. I have never quarreled, returned the other, aware for the first time that his dictatorial brother had sometimes offered occasion for quarrel had he been ready to take it. Well, said Samwen emphatically, if you speak against Whitefell to any other, as tonight you have spoken to me, we shall. He delivered the words like an ultimatum, turned sharp round and re-entered the house. Christian, more fearful and wretched than before, followed. Snow is falling fast, not a single light to be seen. Whitefell's eyes passed over Christian without apparent notice, and turned bright and shining upon Samwen. Nor any signal to be heard, she queried. Did you not hear the sound of a sea horn? I saw nothing and heard nothing. And signal or no signal, a heavy snow would keep you here perforce. She smiled her thanks beautifully, and Christian's heart sank like a lead with a deadly foreboding as he noted with a light was kindled in Samwen's eyes by her smile. That night, when all others slept, Christian, the weariest of all, watched outside the guest chamber till midnight was past. No sound, not the faintest, could be heard. Could the old tale be true of the midnight change? What was on the other side of the door, a woman or a beast? He would have given his right hand to know. Instinctively, he laid his hand on the latch and drew it softly, though believing that bolts fastened the inner sides. The door yielded to his hand. He stood on the threshold. A keen gust of air cut at him. The window stood open, the room empty. So Christian could sleep with a somewhat lightened heart. In the morning there was surprise and conjecture when Whitefell's absence was discovered. Christian held his peace. Not even to his brother did he say how he knew that she had fled before midnight. And Swain, thought evidently, greatly chagrined, seemed to disdain reference to the subject of Christian's fears. The elder brother alone joined the bear hunt. Christian found pretext to stay behind. Samwen, being out of humor, manifested his contempt by uttering not one expostulation. All that day and for many a days after, Christian would never go out of sight of his home. Samwen alone noticed how he unmaneuvered for this and was clearly annoyed by it. Whitefell's name was never mentioned between them, though not seldom was it heard in general talk. Hardly a day passed without Little Roll asking when Whitefell would come again. Pretty Whitefell, who kissed like a snowflake. And if Samwen answered, Christian would be quite sure that the light in his eyes, kindled by Whitefell's smile, had not yet died out. Little Roll, naughty, merry, fair-haired Little Roll. A day came when his feet raced over the threshold never to return, when his chatter and laughter were heard no more, when tears of anguish were swept by eyes that never would see his bright head again, never again, living or dead. He was seen at dusk for the last time escaping from the house with his puppy, a freakish rebellion against old Trella. Later, when his absence had begun to cause anxiety, his puppy crept back to the farm, cowed, whimpering and yelping, a pitiful, dumb lump of terror, without intelligence or courage to guide the frightened search. Roll was never found, nor any trace of him. How he had perished was known only by an awful guest. A wild beast had devoured him. Christian heard the conjecture, a wolf, and a horrible certainty flashed upon him, and he knew what wolf it was. He tried to declare what he knew, but Samwen saw him start at the words with white face and struggling lips, and guessing his purpose, pulled him back and kept him silent, hardly by his imperious grip and wrathful eyes, and one low whisper. Again Christian yielded to his brother's stronger words and will, and against his own judgment consented to silence. Repentance came before the new moon. The first of the year was old. Whitefell came again, smiling as she entered, as though assured of a glad and kindly welcome. And in truth, there was only one who saw again her fair face and strange white garb without pleasure. Samwen's face glowed with delight, while Christian's grew pale and rigid as death. He had given his word to keep silence, but he had not thought that she would dare to come again. Silence was impossible. Face to face with that thing, impossible. Irrepressibly he cried out, "Where is Roll?" Not a quiver disturbed Whitefell's face. She heard, yet remained bright and tranquil. Selwyn's eyes flashed round at his brother dangerously. Among the women, some tears fell at the poor child's name, but none cut alarm from its sudden utterance, for the thought of Roll rose naturally. Where was Roll, who had nestled in the stranger's arms, kissing her, and watched for her since and prattled of her daily? Christian went out silently. Only one thing there was that he could do, and he must not delay. His horror overmastered any curiosity to hear Whitefell's glib excuses and smiling apologies for her strange and uncourteous departure, or her easy tale the circumstances of her return, or to watch her bearing as she heard the sad tale of little Roll. The swiftest runner of the countryside had started on his hardest race, little less than 3 leagues and back, which he reckoned to accomplish in 2 hours. Though the night was moonless and the way rugged, he rushed against the still cold air till it felt like a wind upon his face. The dim homestead sank below the ridges at his back, and fresh ridges of snowlands rose out of the obscure horizon level to drive past him as the stirless air drove, and sink away behind into obscure level again. He took no conscious heed of landmarks, not even when all sign of a path was gone under depths of snow. His will was set to reach his goal with unexampled speed, and thither by instinct his physical forces bore him, without one definite thought to guide. And the idle brain lay passive, inert, receiving into its vacancy restless siftings of past nights and sounds. Roll weeping, laughing, playing, coiled in the arms of that dreadful thing. Tur, oh Tur, white fangs in the black jowl, the women who wept on the foolish puppy, precious for the child's last touch, footprints from pine wood to door, the smiling face among furs, of such womanly beauty, smiling, smiling, and Sewin's face. Sewin, Sewin, oh Sewin, my brother. Sewin's angry laugh possessed his ear within the sound of the wind of his speed. Swen's scorn assailed more quick and keen than the biting cold at his throat, and yet he was unimpressed by any thought of how Swen's scorn and his anger would raise if this errand were known. To the younger brother, all life was a spiritual mystery, veiled from his clear knowledge by the density of flesh, since he knew his own body to be linked to the complex and antagonistic forces that constitute one's soul. It seemed to him not impossibly strange that one spiritual force should possess diverse forms for widely various manifestation. Nor to him was it great effort to believe that as pure water washes away all natural foulness, so water holy by consecration must needs cleanse God's world from that supernatural evil thing. Therefore, faster than ever man's foot had covered those leagues, he sped under the dark, still night, over the waste trackless snow ridges to the faraway church, where salvation lay in the holy water stoop at the door. His faith was as firm as any that wrought miracles in days past, simple as a child's wish, strong as a man's will. He was hardly missed during those hours, every second of which was by him fulfilled to its utmost extent by extremest effort that sinews and nerves could attain. With words and looks of unwonted animation, for the kindly hospitable instincts of the inmates were roused into cordial expressions of welcome and interest by the grace and beauty of the returned stranger. But Sewin was eager and earnest with more than a host's courteous warmth. The impression that at her first coming had charmed him, that had lived since through memory deepened now in her actual presence. Sewin, the matchless among men, acknowledged in this fair white fell a spirit high and bold as his own, and a frame so firm and capable that only bulk was lacking for equal strength. Yet the white skin was molded most smoothly, without much muscular swelling, as made his might evident. Such love as his frank self-love could concede was called forth by an ardent admiration for this supreme stranger. More admiration than love was in his passion, and therefore he was free from a lover's hesitancy and delicate reserve and doubts. Frankly and boldly he courted her favor by looks and tones, and an address that were by his natural ease. Nor was she a woman to be wooed otherwise. Tender whispers and sighs would never gain her ear. but her eyes would brighten and shine if she heard of a brave feat, and her prompt hand in sympathy fell swiftly on the axe haft and clasped it hard. That movement ever fired Swain's admiration anew, and he watched for it, strove to elicit it, and glowed when it came. Wonderful and beautiful was that wrist, slender and steel-strong, the smooth, shapely hand that curved so fast and firm, ready to deal instant death. Desiring to feel the pressure of these hands, this bold lover schemed with palpable directness, proposing that she should hear how their hunting songs were sung, with a chorus that signaled hands to be clasped. So his splendid voice gave the verses, and as the chorus was taken up, he claimed her hands, and even though the easy grip felt, as he desired, the strength that was latent, and the vigor that quickened the very fingertips as the song fired her, and her voice was caught out of her by the rhythmic swell and rang clear on the top of the closing surge. Afterward, she sang alone. For contrast, or in the pride of swaying moods by her voice, she chose a mournful song that drifted along in a minor chant, sad as a wind that dirges. Oh, let me go. Around spin wreaths of snow, the dark earth sleeps below. For up the plain moans on a voice of pain, where shall my babe be lain? In my white breast, lay the sweet life to rest, lay where it can be best. Hush, hush, it cries, tense night is on the skies, two stars are in thine eyes. Come, babe, away, but lie down till dawn be gray, who must be dead by day. This cannot last, but o'er the sickening blast all sorrows shall be past. All kings shall be low bending at thy knee, worshipping life from thee. For men long soar to hope of what's before, to leave the things of yore. Mine and not thine, how deep their jewels shine, peace laps thy head, not mine. Old Trella came tottering from her corner, shaken to additional palsy by an aroused memory. She strained her dim eyes towards the singer, and then bent her head that the very one ear yet sensible to sound might avail of every note. At the close, groping forward, she murmured with a high-pitched quaver of old age. So she sang, my Thora, my last and brightest. What is she like, she whose voice is like my dead Thora's? Are her eyes blue? Blue as the sky. So are my Thora's. Is her hair fair and in plaits to the waist? Even so, answered Whitefell herself, and met the advancing hands with her own, and guided them to corroborate her words by touch. Like my dead Thora's, repeated the old woman, and then her trembling hands rested on the fur-clad shoulders, and she bent forward and kissed the smooth, fair face that Whitefell upturned, nothing loath to receive and return the caress. So Christian saw them as he entered. He stood a moment after the starless darkness and the icy night air, and the fierce, silent 2 hours' race. His senses reeled on sudden entrance into warmth and light and the cheery hum of voices. A sudden, unforeseen anguish assailed him, as now first he entertained the possibility of being overmatched by her wiles and her daring, if at the approach of pure death she should start up, at bay, transformed to a terrible beast, and achieve a savage glut at the last. He looked with horror and pity on the harmless, helpless folk, so unwitting of outrage to their comfort and security, the dreadful thing in their midst, that was veiled from their knowledge by womanly beauty, was a center of pleasant interest. There before him, signally impressive, was poor old Trella, weakest and feeblest of all in fond nearness. And the moment might bring about the revelation of a monstrous horror, a ghastly, deadly danger, set loose and at bay in a circle of girls and women and careless, defenseless men. And he, alone of the throng, prepared. For one breathing space he faltered, no longer than that, while over him swept the agony of compunction that yet could not make him surrender his purpose. He alone? Nay. But Tur also, and he crossed to the dumb soul share of his knowledge. So timeless is thought that a few seconds only lay between his lifting of the latch and his loosening of Tur's collar. But in those few seconds succeeding his first glance, as lightning swift had been the impulses of others, their motion as quick and sure Selwyn's vigilant eye had darted upon him, and instantly his every fiber was alert with hostile instinct. and half divining, half incredulous of Christian's object in stooping to Tur, he came hastily, wary, wrathful, resolute to oppose the malice of his wild-eyed brother. But beyond Selwyn rose Whitefell, blanching white as her furs, and with eyes grown fierce and wild, she leapt down the room to the door, whirling her long robe closely to her. "Hark!" she panted, "the signal horn! Hark! I must go!" as she snatched at the latch to be out and away. For one precious moment Christian had hesitated on the half-loosened collar, for except the womanly form were exchanged for the bestial, Tur's jaws would gnash to rags his honor of manhood. He heard her voice and turned too late. As she tugged at the door, he sprang across, grasping his flask. But Selwyn's dash between and caught him back irresistibly, so that a most frantic effort only availed to wrench one arm free. With that, on the impulse of sheer despair, he cast at her with all his force. The door swung behind her, and the flask flew into fragments against it. Then, as Selwyn's glass slackened, and he met the questioning astonishment of surrounding faces with a hoarse, inarticulate cry. "God help us all," he said. "She is a werewolf!" Selwyn turned upon him. "Liar, coward!" And his hands gripped his brother's throat with deadly force, as though the spoken word could be killed so. And as Christian struggled, lifted him clear off his feet and flung him crashing backward. So furious was he that as his brother lay motionless, he stirred him roughly with his foot, till their mother came between, crying, "Shame!" And yet then he stood by, his teeth set, his brows knit, his hands clenched, ready to enforce silence again violently, as Christian rose, staggering and bewildered. But utter silence and submission was more than he expected, and turned his anger into contempt for one so easily cowed and held in subjugation by mere force. "He is mad," he said, turning on his heel as he spoke, so that he lost his mother's look of pained reproach at his sudden free utterance of what was a lurking dread within her. Christian was too spent for the effort of speech. His hard breath labored, and in great sobs, his limbs were powerless and unstrung and utter relaxed after hard service. His failure in his endeavor induced a stupor of misery and despair. In addition was the wretched humiliation of open violence and strife with his brother, and the distress of hearing misjudging contempt expressed without reserve. For he was aware that Selwyn had turned to allay the scared excitement, half by imperious mastery, half by explanation and argument, that showed painful disregard of brotherly consideration. Selwyn, the other, was observant of his brother, despite the continual check of finding turn and glance where he would, Christian's eyes always upon him, with a strange look of helpless distress, decomposing enough to the angry aggressor. "Like a beaten dog," he said to himself, rallying contempt to withstand compunction. Observation set him wondering on Christian's exhausted condition. The heavy labored breathing and the slack inert fall of the limbs told assuredly of unusual and prolonged exertion. And then why had close upon 2 hours' absence been followed by manifestly hostile behavior towards Whitefell? Suddenly the fragments of the flask gave a clue. He guessed all and faced about to stare at his brother in amaze. He forgot that the motive scheme was against Whitefell, demanding derision and resentment from him that was swept out of remembrance by astonishment and admiration for the feat of speed and endurance. That night Swen and his mother talked long and late together, shaping into certain the suspicion that Christian's mind had lost its balance and discussing the evident cause. For Selwyn declaring his own love for Whitefell suggested that his unfortunate brother, with a like passion, they being twins in love as in birth, had through jealousy and despair turned from love to hate, until reason failed at the strain, and a craze developed with the malice and treachery of madness, made a serious and dangerous force. So Swain theorized, convincing himself as he spoke, convincing afterward others, who advanced doubts against Whitefell, fettering his judgment by his advocacy and by his staunch defense of her unhurried flight, silencing his own inner consciousness of the unaccountability of her actions. But a little time, and Selwyn lost his vantage in the shock of a fresh horror at the homestead. Trella was no more, and her end a mystery. The poor old woman crawled out in a bright gleam to visit a bedridden gossip living beyond the fir grove. Upon the tree she was last seen, halting for her companion, sent back for a forgotten present. Quick alarm sprang, calling every man to the search. Her stick was found among the brushwood near the path, but no track or stain, for a gusty wind was sifting the snow from the branches and hid all signs of how she came by her death. So panic-stricken were the farm folk that none dared go singly on the search. Known danger could be braced, but not to stealthy death that walked by day invisible, that cut off alike the childish play and the aged woman so near to her quiet grave. Roll she kissed, Trella she kissed, so rang Christian's frantic cry again and again, till Swain dragged him away and strove to keep him apart from the rest of the household. But thenceforth all Swain's reasoning and mastery could not uphold White Fell above suspicion. He was not called upon to defend her from accusation when Christian had been brought to silence again, but he well knew the significance of this fact, that her name formerly uttered freely and often, he never heard now. It was huddled away into whispers that he could not catch. For a time the twins' variance was marked on Selwyn's part by an air of rigid indifference, on Christian's by heavy downcast silence, and a nervous apprehensive observation of his brother. Superadded to his remorse and foreboding, Selwyn's displeasure weighed upon him intolerably, and the remembrance of their violent rupture was a ceaseless misery. The elder brother, self-sufficient and insensitive, could little know how deeply his unkindness stabbed. A depth and force of affliction such as Christian's was unknown to him, and his brother's ceaseless surveillance annoyed him greatly. Therefore, that suspicion might be lulled, he judged it wise to make overtures for peace. Most easily done. A little kindliness, a few evidence of consideration, a slight return of the old brother imperiousness, and Christian replied by a gratefulness and relief that might have touched him had he understood all, but instead increased his secret contempt. So successful was his finesse that when late on a day a message summoning Christian to a distance was transmitted by Swain, no doubt of his genuineness occurred. When his errand proving useless, he set out to return. Mistake or misapprehension was all that he surmised. Not till he sighted the homestead lying low between the night-gray snow ridges did vivid recollection of the time when he had tracked that horror to the door rouse in intense dread, and with it a hardly defined suspicion. His grasp tightened on the bare spear that he carried as a staff. Every sense was alert, every muscle strung, excitedly urged him on. Caution checked him, and the two governed his long stride, swiftly, noiselessly, to the climax he felt was at hand. As he drew near to the outer gates, a light shadow stirred and went, as though the gray of the snow had taken detached motion. A darker shadow stayed and faced Christian. Selwyn stood before him, and surely the shadow that went was White Fell. They had been together close. Had she not been in his arms, near enough for lips to meet? There was no moon, but the stars gave light enough to show that Selwyn's face was flushed and elate. The flush remained, though the expression changed quickly at sight of his brother. How, if Christian had been all, could one of his frenzied outbursts be met and managed? By resolution, by indifference, he halted between the two, and as a result he swaggered. White Fell? Questioned Christian breathlessly. Yes. Swain's answer was a query with an intonation implied he was clearing the ground for action. From Christian came, have you kissed her? Like a bolt direct, staggering Selwyn by its sheer prompt temerity. He flushed yet darker, and yet half smiled over this earnest of success he had won. Had there been really between himself and Christian the rivalry that he imagined? His face had enough of the insolence of triumph to exasperate jealous rage. You dare ask this? Swain, oh Swain, I must know. You have. The ring of despair and anguish in his voice angered Swain, misconstruing it. Jealousy so presumptuous was intolerable. Mad fool, he said, constraining himself no longer. Win for yourself a woman to kiss. Leave mine without question. Such a one as I should desire to kiss it is such as one as shall never allow a kiss to you. Then Christian fully understood his supposition. I, he cried. White Fell? That deadly thing? Swain, are you blind, mad? I would save you from her, a werewolf. Swain maddened again at the accusation, a dastardly way of revenge as he conceived, and instantly, for the second time, the brothers were at strife violently. But Christian was now too desperate to be scrupulous, for dim glimpse had shot a possibility into his mind, and to be free to follow it, the striking of his brother was a necessity. Thank God he was armed, and so Selwyn's equal. Facing his assailant with a bear spear, he struck up his arms, and with the butt end hit so hard that he fell. Then the matchless runner leapt away to follow a forlorn hope. Selwyn, on regaining his feet, was as amazed as angry at this unaccountable flight. He knew in his heart that his brother was no coward, and that it was unlike him to shrink from an encounter because defeat was certain, and cruel humiliation from a vindictive victor probable. Of the uselessness of pursuit he was well aware. He must abide his chagrin until his time for advantage should come. Since Whitefell had parted to the right, Christian to the left, the event of a sequent encounter did not occur to him. And now Christian, acting on the dim glimpse he had, just as Sewin turned upon him, of something that moved against the sky along the ridge behind the homestead, was shaking his only hope on a chance and his own superlative speed. If what he saw was really Whitefell, he guessed she was bending her steps toward the open wastes, and there was just a possibility that, by a straight dash and a desperate perilous leap over a sheer bluff, he might yet meet her head-on. And then he had no further thought. It was past the quick, fierce race and the chance of death at the leap, and he halted in a hollow to fetch his breath and to look. Did she come? Had she gone? She came. She came with a smooth, gliding, noiseless speed that was neither walking nor running. Her arms were folded in her furs that were drawn tight about her body. The white lappets from her head were wrapped and knotted closely beneath her face. Her eyes were set on a far distance. Then the even sway of her going was startled to a pause by Christian. Fell! She drew a quick, sharp breath at the sound of her name, thus mutilated, and faced Swain's brother. Her eyes glittered, her upper lip was lifted and showed the teeth. The half of her name, impressed with an ominous sense, as uttered by him, warned her of the aspect of a deadly foe. Yet she cast loose her robes till they trailed ample and spoke as a mild woman. "What would you?" Christian answered with a solemn, dreadful accusation. "You kissed Roll, and Roll is dead. You kissed Trella, she is dead. You have kissed Swain, you're my brother, but he shall not die." He added, "You may live till midnight." The edge of the teeth and the glitter of the eyes stayed a moment, and her right hand also slid to the axe haft. Then without a word she swerved from him and sprang out and away swiftly over the snow. And Christian sprang out and away and followed her swiftly over the snow, keeping behind but half a stride's length from her side. So they went running together, silent, towards the vast wastes of snow where no living thing, but they too moved under the stars at night. Never before had Christian so rejoiced in his powers. The gift of speed and the training of use and endurance were priceless to him now. Though midnight was hours away, he was confident that go where the fell thing would hasten as she would, she could not outstrip him nor escape from him. Then, when came the time for transformation, when the woman's form made no longer a shield against a man's hand, he could slay or be slain to save Swain. He had struck his dear brother in dire extremity, but he could not, though reason urged, strike a woman. For 1 mile, for 2 miles, they ran. Whitefell ever foremost, Christian ever at an equal distance from her side, so near that now and again her outflying furs touched them. She spoke no word, nor he. She never turned her head to look at him, nor swerved to evade him, but with her set face looking forward sped straight on, over rough, over smooth, aware of his nearness by the regular beat of his feet and the sound of his breath behind. In a while she quickened her pace. From the first, Christian had judged at her speed as admirable, yet with exulting security in his own excelling and enduring whatever her efforts. But when the pace increased, he found himself put to the test as never had been done before in any race. Her feet indeed flew faster than his. It was only by his length of stride that he kept his place at her side. But his heart was high and resolute, and he did not fear failure yet. So the desperate race flew on. Their feet struck up the powdery snow. Their breath smoked into the sharp, clear air, and they were gone before the air was cleared of snow and vapor. Now and then Christian glanced up to judge, by the rising of the stars, of the coming of midnight. So long, so long. Whitefell held on without slack. She, it was evidence, with confidence in her speed, proving matchless, as resolute to outrun her pursuer as he to endure till midnight and fulfill his purpose. And Christian held on, still self-assured. He could not fail, he would not fail. To avenge Roll and Trella was motive enough for him to do what man could do, but for Swain more. She had kissed Swain, but he should not die too. With Swain to save, he could not fail. Never before was such a race as this. No, not when old Greece, man and maid, raced together with two fates at stake, for the hard running was sustained unabated, while star after star rose and went wheeling up toward midnight, for 1 hour, for 2 hours. Then Christian saw and heard what shot him through with fear. Where a fringe of trees hung around the slope, he saw something dark moving and heard a yelp, followed by a full, horrid cry, and the dark spread out upon the snow, a pack of wolves in pursuit. Of the beast alone he had little cause for fear. At the pace he held he could distance them. Four-footed though they were, but of Whitefell's wiles he had infinite apprehension. For how might she not avail herself of the savage jaws of these wolves, akin as they were to half her nature? She vouchsafed them to them, nor look nor sign, but Christian, on an impulse to assure himself that she should not escape him, caught and held the far-flung edge of her furs running still. She turned like a flash with a beastly snarl, teeth and eyes gleaming again. Her axe shone on the upstroke, on the downstroke, as she hacked at his hand. She had lopped it off at the wrist, but that he parried with a bear spear. Even then she shone through the shaft and shattered the bones of the hand so that he loosed perforce. Then again they raced on as before, Christian not losing a pace, though his left hand swung bleeding and broken. The snarl indubitably, though modified from a woman's organs, the vicious fury revealed in teeth and eyes, the sharp, arrogant pain of her maiming blow caught away Christian's heed of the beast behind, by striking into him close, vivid realization of the infinitely greater danger that ran before him in that deadly thing. When he bethought him to look behind, lo, the pack had but reached their tracks and instantly slunk aside, cowed, the yell of pursuit changing to yelps and whines. So abhorrent was that fell creature to beast as to man. She had drawn her furs more closely to her, disposing them so that instead of flying loose at her heels, no drapery hung lower than her knees, and this without a check to her wonderful speed nor embarrassment by the cumberings of the folds. She held her head as before. Her lips were firmly set. Only the tense nostrils gave her breath. Not a sign of distress witnessed to the long sustaining of that terrible speed. But on Christian by now the strain was telling palpably. His head weighed heavy, and his breath came laboring in great sobs. The bear spear would have been a burden now. His heart was beating like a hammer, but such a dullness oppressed his brain that it was only by degrees he could realize his helpless state, wounded and weaponless, chasing that thing that was fierce, desperate, axe-armed woman, except she should assume the beast with fangs, yet more deadly. And still the far, slow stars, when lingering nearly an hour from midnight. So far was his brain astray that an impression took him that she was fleeing from the midnight stars, whose gain was by such slow degrees that a time equaling days and days had gone in the race round the northern circle of the world, and days as long might last before the end, except she slackened or except he failed. But he would not fail yet. How long had he been praying so? He had started with a self-confidence and reliance that had felt no need for that aid, and now it seemed that only means by which to restrain his heart from swelling beyond the compass of his body, by which to cherish his brain from dwindling and shriveling quite away. Some sharp-toothed creature kept tearing and dragging on his maimed left hand. He never could see it, he could not shake it off, but he prayed it off at times. The clear stars before him took to the shuddering, and he knew why. They shuddered at sight of what was behind him. He had never divined before that strange thing hid themselves from men under pretense of being snow-clad mounds of swaying trees, but now they came slipping out from their harmless covers to follow him and mock at his impotence to make a kindred thing resolve to truer form. He knew the air behind him was thronged. He heard the hum of innumerable murmurings together, but his eyes could never catch them. They were too swift and nimble, but he knew that they were there, because on a backward glance he saw the snow mounds surge as they groveled, flatlings out of sight. He saw the trees reel as they screwed themselves rigid, past recognition among the boughs. After such the glance of stars for a while returned to steadfastness, and an infinite stretch of silence rose upon the chill gray world, only deranged by the swift even beat of the flying feet and his own, slower from the long stride and the sound of his breath. And for some clear moments he knew that his only concern was to sustain his speed regardless of pain and distress, to deny with every nerve he had her power to outstrip him or to widen the space between them, till the stars crept up to midnight. A hideous check came to the race. Whitefell swirled about and leapt to the right, and Christian, unprepared for so prompt a lurch, found close at his feet a deep pit yawning, and his own impetus past control. But he snatched at her as he bore past, clasping her right arm with his one whole hand, and the two swung together upon the brink. And her straining away in self-preservation was vigorous enough to counterbalance his headlong impulse and brought them reeling together to safety. Then, before he was verily sure that they were not to perish so crashing down, he saw her gnashing in wild, pale fury as she wrenched to be free, and since her right arm was in his grasp, used her axe left-handed, striking back at him. The blow was effectual enough, even so his right arm dropped powerless, gashed, and with a lesser bone broken, that jarred with hard pain when he let it swing, as he leapt out again and ran to recover the few feet she had gained from his paws at the shock. The near escape and this new quick pain made again every faculty alive and intense. He knew that what he followed was most surely death animate. Wounded and helpless, he was utterly at her mercy, if so she should realize and take action. Hopeless to avenge, hopeless to save. His very despair for Swain swept him on to follow and follow, and precede the kiss doomed to death. Could he yet fail to hunt that thing past midnight, out of the womanly form, alluring and treacherous, into lasting restraint of the bestial, which was the last shred of hope left from the confident purpose of the outset? The last hour from midnight had lost half its quarters, and the stars were lifting up the great minutes. And again, his greatening heart and his shrinking brain, and the sickening agony that swung at either side, conspired to appall the will that had only seeming empire over his feet. Now Whitefell's body was so closely enveloped that not a lap nor an edge flew free. She stretched forward strangely aslant, leaning from the upright poise of a runner. She cleared the ground at times by long bounds, gaining an increase of speed that Christian agonized to equal. He grew bewildered, uncertain of his own identity, doubting of his own true form. He could not be really a man, no more than that running thing was really a woman. His real form was only hidden under embodiment of a man, but what it was he did not know. And Swain's real form he did not know. Swain lay fallen at his feet where he had struck him down, his own brother. He stumbled over him. He had to overleap him and race harder, because she who had kissed Swain leapt so fast. Swain, Swain, oh Swain. Why did the star stop to shudder? Midnight else had surely come. The leaping, leaning thing looked back at him a wild, fierce look, and laughed in savage scorn and triumph. He saw in a flash why, for within a time measurable by seconds, she would have escaped him utterly. As the land lay a slope of ice sunk on the one hand, on the other hand a steep rose shouldering forward. Between the two was space for a foot to be planted, but none for a body to stand. Yet a juniper bow thrusting out gave a handhold secure enough for one, with a resolute grasp, to swing past the perilous place and pass on safe. Though the first seconds of the last moment were going, she dared to flash back a wicked look and laugh at the pursuer who was impotent to grasp. The crisis struck convulsive life into his last supreme effort. His will surged up indomitable. His speed proved matchless yet. He leapt with a rush past her before her laugh had time to go out, and turned short, bearing the way, and braced to withstand her. She came hurtling, desperate with a feint, to the right hand, and then launched herself upon him with a spring, like a wild beast when it leaps to kill. And he, with one strong arm and a hand that could not hold, with one strong arm and an arm that could not guide and sustain, he caught and held her even so, and they fell together. And because he felt his whole arm slipping and his whole hand loosening to slack the dreadful agony of the wrenched bone above, he caught and held with his teeth the tunic at her knee as she struggled up and wrung off his hands to overleap him victorious. Like lightning she snatched her axe and struck him on the neck. Deep, once, twice, his lifeblood gushed out, staining her feet. The stars touched midnight. The death scream he heard was not his, for his set teeth had hardly yet relaxed when it rang out, and the dreadful cry began with a woman's shriek, and changed and ended as the yell of a beast, and before the final blank overtook his dying eyes, he saw that she gave place to it. He saw more, that life gave place to death, incomprehensibly. For he did not dream that no holy water could be more holy, more potent to destroy an evil thing than the life blood of a pure heart poured out for another in willing devotion. His own true hidden reality that he had desired to know grew palpable, recognizable. It seemed to him just this, a great, glad, abounding hope that he had saved his brother, too expansive to be contained by the limited form of a soul man. It yearned for a new embodiment, infinite as the stars. What did it matter to that true reality that the man's brain shrank, till it was nothing, that the man's body could not retain the huge pain of his heart, and heaved it out through the red exit riven at the neck. That hurtling blackness blotted out forever the man's sight, hearing, sense. In the early gray of day, Swain chanced upon the footprints of a man, of a runner, as he saw by the shifted snow and the direction they had taken aroused curiosity, since a little further their line must be crossed by the edge of a sheer height. He turned to trace them, and so doing, the length of the stride struck his attention, a stride long as his own if he ran. He knew he was following Christian. In his anger, he had hardened himself to be indifferent to the night-long absence of his brother, but now, seeing where the footsteps went, he was seized with compunction and dread. He had failed to give thought and care to his poor frantic twin, who might, was it possible, have rushed to a frantic death. His heart stood still when he came to the place where the leap had taken place. A piled edge of snow had fallen, too, and nothing lay below when he peered. Along the upper edge he ran for a furlong, till he came to a dip where he could slip and climb down, and then back again, on the lower level to the pile of fallen snow. There he saw that the vigorous running had started afresh. He stood pondering, vexed that any man should have taken that leap where he had not ventured to follow, vexed that he had been beguiled to such painful emotions, guessing vainly at Christian's object in this mad freak. He began sauntering along half unconsciously, following his brother's track, and so in a while he came to the place where the footprints were doubled. Small prints were those others, small as a woman's, though the pace from one to another was longer than that which the skirts of women allow. Did not Whitefell tread so? A dreadful guess appalled him, so dreadful that he recoiled from belief. Yet his face grew ashy white, and he gasped to fetch back motion to his checked heart. Unbelievable? Closer attention showed how the smaller footfall had altered for greater speed, striking into the snow with a deeper onset and a lighter pressure on the heels. Unbelievable? Could any woman but Whitefell run so? Could any man but Christian run so? The guess became a certainty. He was following where alone in the dark night Whitefell had fled from Christian pursuing. Such villainy set heart and brain on fire with rage and indignation. Such villainy in his own brother, till lately love-worthy, praiseworthy, though a fool for meekness. He would kill Christian, had he lives as many as the footprints he had trodden. Vengeance should demand them all. In a tempest of murderous hate, he followed on in haste, for the track was plain enough, starting with such a burst of speed as could not be maintained, but brought him back soon to a plod for the spent, sobbing breath to be regulated. Mile after mile he traveled with a bursting heart. More piteous, more tragic seemed to be the case, as this evidence of Whitefell's splendid supremacy, holding her own so long against Christian's famous speed. So long that his love and admiration grew more and more boundless, and his grief and indignation therewith also. Whenever the track lay clear, he ran, with such reckless prodigy of strength that it was soon spent, and he dragged on heavily, till sometime on the ice of a mere, sometimes on a windswept place, all signs were lost. But so undeviating had been their line that a course straight on, and then short questing to either hand recovered them again. Hour after hour had gone, by through more than half that winter day, before ever he came to the place where the trampled snow showed that a scurry of feet had come and gone, wolf's feet, and gone, most amazingly. Only a little beyond he came to the lopped point of Christian's bare spear. Farther on he would see where the remnant of the useless shaft had been dropped. The snow here was dashed with blood, and the footsteps of the two had fallen closer together. Some hoarse sound of exultation came from him that might have been a laugh had breath sufficed. "Oh, Whitefell, my poor, brave love." "Well struck," he groaned, torn by his pity and great admiration, as he guessed surely how she had turned and dealt the blow. The sight of the blood inflamed him as it might a beast that ravens. He grew mad with a desire to once again have Christian by the throat, not to loose this time till he had crushed out his life, or beat out his life, or stabbed out his life, or all of these, and torn him piecemeal likewise. And ah, then, not till then, bleed his heart with weeping like a child, like a girl, or the piteous fate of his poor lost love. On, on, through the aching time, toiling and straining in the track of those two superb runners, aware of the marvel of their endurance, but unaware of the marvel of their speed, that in the 3 hours before midnight had overpassed all that vast distance that he could only traverse from twilight to twilight, for clear daylight was passing when he came to the edge of an old marl pit, and saw how the two who had gone before had stamped and trampled together in desperate peril on the verge, and here fresh bloodstains spoke of him, of a valiant defense against his infamous brother, and he followed where the blood had dripped till the cold had staunched its flow, taking a savage gratification from the evidence that Christian had been gashed deeply, maddening afresh with desire to do likewise, more excellently in so shake his murderous hate. And he began to know that through all his despair he had entertained a germ of hope that grew apace, rained upon by his brother's blood. He strove on as best he could, wrung now by an access of hope, now of despair and agony, to reach the end, however terrible, sick with the aching of the toiled miles that deferred it, and the light when lingering out of the sky giving place to uncertain stars. He came to the finish. Two bodies lay in a narrow place. Christian's was one, but the other beyond, not Whitefell's. There, where the footsteps ended, lay a great white wolf. At the sight, Swain's strength was blasted. Body and soul, he was struck down groveling. The stars had grown short and intense before he stirred from where he had dropped prone. Very feebly, he crawled to his dead brother and laid his hand upon him and crouched so, afraid to look or stir further. Cold, stiff, hours dead, yet the dead body was his only shelter and stay in that most dreadful hour. His soul, stripped bare of all comfort, cowered, shivering, naked, abject, and the living clung to the dead out of piteous need for grace from the soul that had passed away. He rose to his knees, lifting the body. Christian had fallen face forward in the snow, with his arm flung up and wide, and so had the frost made him rigid, strange, ghastly, unyielding to Swain's lifting, so that he laid him down again and crouched above, with his arm fast round him, and a low, heart-wrung groan. When at last he found force to raise his brother's body and gather it in his arms, tight clasped to his breast, he tried to face the thing that lay beyond. The sight set his limbs in a palsy with horror and dread. His senses had failed and fainted in our cowardice, but for the strength that came from holding dead Christian in his arms, enabling him to compel his eyes to endure the sight and take into the brain the complete aspect of the thing. No wound, only bloodstains on the feet. The great grim jaws had a savage grin, though dead stiff. And his kiss? He could bear it no longer and turned away, nor ever looked again. And the dead man in his arms, knowing the full horror had followed and faced it for his sake, had suffered agony and death for his sake. In the neck was the deep death gash, one arm and both hands were dark with frozen blood for his sake. Dead. He knew him as in life he had not known him. To give the right meat of love and worship, he longed for annihilation, that so he might lose the agony of knowing himself so unworthy, such perfect love. The frozen calm of death on the face appalled him. He dared not touch it with lips that had cursed so lately, with lips fouled by a kiss of the horror that had been death. He struggled to his feet, still clasping Christian. The dead man stood upright within his arms, frozen, rigid. The eyes were not quite closed. The head had stiffened, bowed slightly to one side. The arms stayed straight and wide. It was the figure of one crucified, the blood-stained hands also conforming. So living and dead went back along the track, that one had passed in the deepest passion of love, and one in the deepest passion of hate. All that night Swain toiled through the snow, bearing the weight of dead Christian, treading back along the steps he before had trodden when he was wronging, with vilest thoughts and cursing with murderous hate, the brother who all the while lay dead for his sake.